Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we are coming to you live from one of the most beautiful cities in the entire world. It's a summer day, as you can see behind me here in St. Petersburg. This is one of the most economic forums, one of the most important economic forums in the entire world. It's called the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, International Economic Forum to be exact. And there are some 170 people here. There's foreign ministers, economic ministers, men and women of industries, heads of state, all here discussing the economies of their countries, respectively, as the world changes, because obviously many of us know now that the world is not led anymore by just one faction, but rather by what is often called the Global South. Those are the folks that are primarily represented here on this day. It's a very important news-making event, and we are going to be talking to many of those newsmakers, including Maria Sakharova, who is the director of information for the Foreign Ministry of Russia, by far one of the most important voices, the voice of the Foreign Ministry of Russia. So she's going to be joining us here in a little while. Lots to talk about, as well as the news that's taking place around the world. This is The Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Before we talk to Maria Sakharova, I wanted to talk to you about some of the things that are taking place around the world right now. It's almost impossible to step away without seeing just how important this situation that's developing between Israel and Iran is at this point. Something happened, though. Something happened over the weekend that I want to start with. The G7 was held in Canada. It was hosted by Mark Carney, Prime Minister of Canada. Mr. Trump shows up, and the first words out of Mr. Trump's mouth are, the G7 needs to turn into the G8, and Russia needs to be included once again. We have this on tape. I want you to see it. Here it is.
The G7 used to be the G8. Barack Obama and a person named Trudeau didn't want to have Russia in. And I would say that that was a mistake, because I think you wouldn't have a war right now if you had Russia in. And you wouldn't have a war right now if Trump were president 4 years ago. But it didn't work out that way. But it used to be the G8. And now it's, I guess, what's that, 9 years ago, 8 years ago, it switched over. They threw Russia out, which I claimed was a very big mistake. Even though I wasn't in politics then, I was very loud about it. It was a mistake in that you spend so much time talking about Russia, and he's no longer at the table. So it makes life more complicated. But you wouldn't have had the war.
It's fascinating to hear him say, you spend all your time talking about Russia, why not just have them at the table? If you're going to be talking about them, why not talk to them, is the point that he's making. And how did that go over? Like a lead balloon. As a matter of fact, while he was then being asked questions by reporters about that statement that he made, some of the other heads of state apparently were flustered, frustrated, angry. Mark Carney kind of shut it off and immediately interrupted. Mr. Trump then left. In fact, I think, Gene, we have that video. I want to show it to you. This is Donald Trump getting on a helicopter, and he's flying away before the G7 actually concluded. While Mr. Trump is arguing that maybe it should be turned into a G8, maybe we should just include Russia and China, as a matter of fact. I think the point he's making, if you're going to talk about these countries, why not talk to them at the same time? Well, that, again, did not go over well with some of these leaders. One of the persons that didn't go over well is Starmer, obviously the Prime Minister of the UK, who was... Here's another video I want to show you. This is Starmer being asked by a reporter from the BBC about his potential involvement, or his country's potential involvement, in Iran. And the reporter's getting at something very important here, because so many UK citizens were affected by the war in Ukraine. In fact, look, 4% decline in wages since the war in Ukraine in UK, and an 11% increase in inflation. So the citizens of UK are paying for the decision that their leaders have made in Ukraine. So this reporter asks Starmer, are you worried that this is going to be a punishment again on the citizens of the UK? Here's what he says.
How worried are you about the economic impact of the conflict back home on people's bills?
Well, I'm always concerned about the impact of economic of international issues back on people back at home.
Yet another shock.
Well, you saw with Ukraine the direct impact it had on energy bills and on the cost of living. Equally, with this conflict with Israel and Iran, at a time of conflict globally, there is always going to be an impact domestically. You can see the effect it's having on the economy, particularly the
and
price
of energy.
And you
fear that sort of knock-on for people?
Well, of course I do. Yeah. I don't want to have that impact on the lives of people in the United Kingdom. And my job is to insulate and safeguard and mitigate that risk to everybody watching this, everybody across the United Kingdom.
You know, what I found fascinating about that comment, and maybe you did too, was he's admitting to it. He's saying, yes, he volunteered the information when he says, look, you know, the our involvement in the war in Ukraine has led to people in the UK having to pay the price because of their economy and their living conditions. He's admitting to this. And then one would think, and maybe this is just my observation, one would think that as the head of state of the UK, he would say, the most important thing for me is the well-being of my citizens. But instead, he's saying, well, you know, if the citizens have to suffer a little bit because of these decisions that we made, then so be it. Even though you have to ask yourself, what has Iran ever done to the UK? I understand the friction between Iran and Israel, but the UK? And finally, the same situation is taking place in the United States, by the way. And I want you to know that this is an argument that a lot of people are bringing from the MAGA perspective and even being critical of Mr. Trump because they believe he's being sucked in by these folks who want him to essentially create another Iraq, but this time in Iran. Listen to this conversation. This is Tucker Carlson, who you know, I know well, talking to Ted Cruz about why would you want to go into Iraq? And then he asks him, tell me a little bit, pardon me, Iran, tell me a little bit about Iran. Tell me about the population of Iran. Tell me about the demographics of Iran. Watch this, it's startling.
How many people live in Iran, by the way?
I don't know the population.
At all?
No, I don't know the population.
You don't know the population of the country you seek to topple?
I don't sit around memorizing population tables.
What's the ethnic mix of Iran?
They are Persians and predominantly Shia. Okay,
You don't know anything about Iran. So,
okay,
actually,
I am not the Tucker Carlson expert on Iran.
You're a senator who's calling for the overthrow of the government.
You're the one who
claims. You don't know anything about the country.
No, you don't know anything about the country. You're the one who claims they're not trying to murder Donald Trump.
I'm not saying that.
Who can't figure out if it was a good idea to kill General Soleimani, and you said it was bad.
You don't believe they're trying to murder Trump.
Yes, I do.
Because you're not calling for military strikes against them in retaliation. And if you really believe that.
We're carrying out military strikes today.
You said Israel was.
Right, with our help. I'm said we. Israel is leading them, but we're supporting them.
Well, you're breaking news here, because the U.S. government last night denied, the National Security Council spokesman Alex Pfeiffer denied on behalf of Trump that we were acting on Israel's behalf in any offensive capacity.
No, we're not bombing them. Israel's bombing them.
You just said we were.
We are supporting
Israel.
This is
high stakes. You're a senator. If you're saying the United States government is at war with Iran right now, people are listening.
Okay. We're also joined by somebody who, in her own right, is as important as any of the people who are here. Maria Zakharova is a director of information for the Foreign Ministry of Russia. It's a real honor and a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good afternoon. Actually, I would like to correct you, although I'm flattered by this presentation of my humble figure, but the most important person here is just arriving. That's the president of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Putin. And it's not quite the title he gave to himself, like many Western leaders. I think that's the title given to him. That's the way he is perceived by people all over the globe. I mean, hundreds of millions of people perceive the president of Russia this way, thanks to his work, thanks to his stance, thanks to his consistency and his knowledge of history. I've been listening to your reports, to your coverage, to fragments of Tucker Carlson's interview with an American senator who doesn't know how many people live in Iran, although he calls for bombing it. And I don't know know the name of that senator, and I don't care, actually. But the whole world knows the name of the president of the Russian Federation, and they understand that their hopes are with Russia. So we're looking forward to President Putin's speech here, to his meetings with lots of international guests. Probably you don't know, but you are in the center of global isolation. This is why thousands of people from all over the world are walking around here. Well, you just wait. If you're offered some isolation, don't refuse.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm glad you mentioned President Putin, because he's in an interesting situation. He has loyalties to Iran. While the rest of the world sanctioned Russia, punished Russia, most would argue unnecessarily, Iran became a friend, and Russia has been a friend to Iran, like Russia's a friend to China, Russia's a friend to India and South Africa and Brazil. Mr. Trump calls Mr. Putin and says, I want you to help me with this situation in Iran. It's a tough place to put Mr. Putin in, isn't it?
Well, let's break the situation down. Right now, Israel is bombing Iran, and the Western world keeps saying that Israel, they think, has the right to do it. The West seems to have forgotten in an instant about human rights, about children, obviously in the midst of hell. The Western community seems to have forgotten the journalists that are supposed to be protected. They pretend not to see bomb strikes against TV stations. They don't see bomb strikes delivered against nuclear facilities. But maybe you know, let me ask you, what has Iran done wrong? What is it being bombed for? There has to be a very specific answer to this question, a very specific one, obviously, because when you park a car the wrong way in Manhattan, say, a cop turns out, issues you a fine, produces photos, and when you appear in court, you are shown what you did wrong, and you can appeal that. Right now, Iran every day suffers bomb strikes and responds to them. So what is it being bombed for? If we're talking about human rights, there are experts there who are staying there who say they haven't seen violations there. Israel say they don't like the regime in Iran, the political regime. Can I ask you a question? Were there different regimes? There were different regimes in Iran, and people didn't like them as well. But the most important, if we're talking about civilized countries and about democracy and international relationships, whether you like a regime or you don't, if it doesn't attack you, and if it doesn't do or say anything that, from the point of view of international legislation, create a direct threat to people or a state, you have no right to change that regime. You have no right to say that since you don't like it, it has to be destroyed. So I would like to see an answer to this very simple question. There has to be one, obviously. What has Iran done wrong?
But that's their second story. Their first story was, we have to go in because they're this close to being able to weaponize their nuclear system, and they're going to have weapons of mass destruction. Now, I should add, and I know you're thinking this, that Mr. Netanyahu has been saying that for something like 25 to 30 years. Do you think there's enough evidence that they were this close to having nuclear weapons?
Дело в том, что несколько стран в мире.
The thing is that several countries in the world have already got nuclear weapons, but have not recognized that officially. So I wonder, is Israel going to bomb them as well, Israel included? Because these are logical questions that, well, beg for answers. Is Israel going to bomb other states as well, or are other states that de facto have nuclear weapons are going to get bombed again? There are states who have acknowledged the ownership of nuclear weapons. That's five states, permanent members of the UN Security Council: Russia, China, US, Britain, and France. These countries legally have nuclear weapons. There are, however, other states that do possess nuclear weapons, but keep mum about it, but everybody knows they have nuclear weapons. Is this now an excuse? And as you said, they're not just about to get nuclear weapons. They already have them. They already possess nuclear weapons, as Israel is said to possess nuclear weapons. Is this an excuse to start bombing them? Am I right? There are international institutions. There's the IAEA. There are lots of international bodies, watchdogs and regulations and documents that regulate these issues. It's not a matter of somebody trying to solve this issue on their own. It's a matter of international legislation. But legislation has to be approached with specific facts at hand. The IAEA already said that they have not a single fact proving that Iran had violated any treatments, conventions, or regulations. So the question is, we have heard multiple statements from Israel that they have proof that Iran is one step away from creating weapons of mass destruction. Why can't they just show the documents to anyone? Just like for 3 years, the Kiev regime and Zelensky, backed by the same Western countries that are currently backing Israel, for several years Zelensky had said that Russia and Russian leadership personally abducted Ukrainian children. They said 1 million or 1.5 million Ukrainian children. And then they decided that this figure was so crazy that it's not worth repeating. And they started saying 20,000 Ukrainian children stolen, abducted. But not once have we seen a list of those children. Not a single name. And during the talks in Istanbul, they passed a list of 339 names, not 339,000, 339 kids that had not been abducted at all. You know that very well. You live in America. How many kids in America are currently missed by their parents? They are missing, and parents don't know where they are. And considering that for 10 years there has been a terrible domestic war, of course, there are children who cannot be located by their parents, unfortunately. They were saying things they couldn't
prove. We're going to talk a lot about Ukraine because there's so much to say. Let me ask you one final question about the situation with Iran. I'm going to ask you this question as an American. I'm an American citizen. I love my country. But we're starting to get a sense in America.
Sorry to say, just to clarify this issue, what part of your country do you love more?
The spirit.
I'm sorry.
The spirit.
I need to ask this.
The spirit and the heart of the American people.
Oh, something in between.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Something that is great about the people, not the government, not the people who lead. But here's the feeling we're getting.
Oh, my God.
Here's the feeling we're getting in America. Here's what it is. That
there is something bipolar in this saying, you know?
Loving your country?
No, loving America. Because it's not joined together right now.
No, it's not.
I'm sorry to say this, but I've spent there several years, and I was watching how it was collapsing, and now it's, I'm sorry, in a deep, deep trouble, because it's divided. It's divided not into political parties or political movements, but, I mean, the society is divided. It's like crash, boom, bang. I'm sorry to say this.
Your English is fantastic.
I'm sorry.
Don't be. I think this is exactly what we need to do. Is these conversations are rich and they're real. And the point I was going to make is, as an American who has an admiration for my people, my country, the place that gave me an opportunity, as an immigrant who came there from Cuba, I'm upset, and so are many Americans, that suddenly our foreign policy is being dictated by a country about this big called Israel and some man named Netanyahu, who seems to be my new president, I guess. Does it bother you to see America being led by the nose by Israel so often? And by the way, I would argue, Maria, that it's not just Iran, it's Syria, it's Iraq, it's Afghanistan, it's Yemen. These are the reasons we go into these countries, because some small country in the Middle East says, you have to do this for us. My take.
If we step back a little, I'd like to say, you said that people in the United States, people who make decisions in the U.S., have no idea of the countries or nations they're dealing with or countries they're about to bomb. Well, let's not say attack, but they're about to liberate. Let me give you specific examples. 2014, I was there at those negotiations, the Russian-American negotiations.
Yeah.
The delegation was headed by Minister Lavrov and by John Kerry on the American side. A very dramatic event. A regime is changing in Ukraine. The legal regime is being ousted, with Nuland, Deputy State Secretary, handing out cookies, or whatever that was, to protesters, Minister of Foreign Affairs of Germany, France, Poland, the Baltic States, demand the crowd, the people, to overturn the government. That was a madness and chaos and collapse. And against that background, the negotiations are taking place. There's Mr. Kerry sitting there reading out some documents, and Minister Lavrov is trying to tell him to look not as much at the papers, but to listen about the facts that are on the ground, that are really taking place at the moment. So he tells him about the history of Ukraine. He starts telling him about what's going on there, about what Ukrainians are, what Russians are, and what the Kievan Rus is. 6 months passes, and that's enough for the regime in Ukraine to be overturned, Crimea to go to Russia by way of referendum, and there's shooting breaking out. The Kiev regime shoots at people in Donbass and rolls tanks in there. And there's another round of talks with Kerry, and what does Kerry say? He says, Sergei, addressing Minister Lavrov, now I know much more about Ukraine than 6 months ago. Well, what kept you from looking into that right away? How about reading a book, watching a movie on what you do? Not because it doesn't befit people occupying such high positions to be so unqualified. I'm not talking about Kerry right now, because it means people's lives, and you and your family may find yourself in a similar situation. You can have loads of money, you can have a very high office, you can live anywhere, but life can take a very sharp turn.
You were yelling at me a little while ago, so maybe I'm going to give it back to you now. You ready? Maybe, and I know what you're saying, and you're absolutely right, Maria. The U.S. and NATO were doing military exercises in the Black Sea in front of Russians who were just taking their families to go bathe in the beach. They were militarizing Ukraine. They did a coup for a regime change. They did a lot of horrible, awful things that nobody in the world knows enough about, and they should know. Do you ever think that maybe, and I know it's your job and you do a very good job, why weren't you able to convince the rest of the world, look at what they're doing, of course we have to react? Did you ever think that maybe the game plan, the strategy for you and for Russia needs to change so that you can get more people to see the truth? Pardon me for asking.
No, I like tough questions. Я вам вот это вот сейчас все обратно отдам.
But let me give it all back to you. The answer is very simple, because the world media are occupied, as simple as that. They're occupied by those who have loads of money and loads of political influence. So the American mass media are not objective, they're not transparent, they're not credible. They are a way of retranslating a political agenda. The American media is employed by American media employs lots of amazing journalists with amazing education, great profession, criminals, but eventually they all have to make a choice. Either they continue to fight, and then they end up like Tucker Carlson, unemployed, or they have to mutate to suit the agenda they have to pursue. You have read American newspapers, obviously. I spent 3 years in New York, and every day my job was to open newspapers. I had a stack of 5 newspapers every day. By the way, Christian Science Monitor was one of the decent publications, and every day it was like a lottery. Maybe this day I'm lucky to see at least one publication on Russia. And later I realized that the American mass media, the TV, the newspapers, the radio, they pursue a policy that I personally... And later I realized when documents surfaced about USAID, I realized that they call this policy strategic silence. And Russia, let me tell you frankly, I worked there in 2005 till 2008. Russia had 2 kinds of news. The first kind was criminal news, Russian mafia, terrorist attacks, mafia rumbles, people killed in the streets. And the second kind of news was freaks, like a woman living with 150 cats in her apartment. It's not what I call freaks. That's the sort of people the American media call freaks. And that, given the fact that since 2005-2008, Russia built plants, factories, lots of museums, theaters. We made tons of interesting films, very good cinema. Nothing of that was ever covered. There were 2 or 3 news.
Exhibition, This is Russia.
Right.
This is Russia. That was one piece of good news in American media. It was 2005. And there were 2 more articles in U.S. newspapers about Russian opera stars who came to Carnegie Hall and ballet stars, ballet performance in ballet theater in the center of Manhattan. This is it. Все.
Nothing else ever made it to the U.S. media. No good things about young people, about elderly people, about nature. Nothing. I think that's an agenda. You know, Russia tried. We tried hiring American PR agencies. We spent lots of money. Zero. And when we asked, why don't you do something that would be visible, the answer was, if you hadn't hired us, there would be more bad news about Russia. We tried.
Guilty. Guilty.
We established Russia Today. We established media outlets in all languages. They were blocked in a deliberate policy. And the last answer to your question. Could we have made people understand how things were really were? 90 years ago, could we have made people in the U.S. understand, in the U.S., in Germany, Italy, and France, about the monstrous phenomenon of fascism? No, because there was Goebbels propaganda in place, which had the whole Europe enthralled with stories of great Third Reich. And the United States of America wouldn't allow truthful information about processes developing in Central Europe. And in the territory of the United States of America, there were meetings and rallies and conventions of Nazi parties. And the UK would salute using the Nazi salute. This is the answer. It's been almost a century, but the mistakes are being made all the same. There's neo-Nazism emerging in the center of Europe. It's emerging as a terrorist cell in Ukraine, and the ideology of Nazism is penetrating, infiltrating the NATO, the European Union, other countries. And nobody
there
seems to notice anything.
There is a little bit of room for optimism. And I'll tell you where I see some optimism. I think Mr. Trump generally likes Russia. I think Mr. Trump wanted to do business as a businessman in Russia by putting a hotel here. I think Mr. Trump, and I've heard him say this on many occasions, respects the fact that Russia has 150 to 160 million potential consumers who love American products and would buy American products if America would only want to do business with Russia. I think Russia, just in my small time here, and I'm not an expert on Russia, represents what America says it wants to be: clean, green, pro-family, economically viable. The things that I hear America say they want to be is what I see in Russia today. So I'm wondering if Mr. Trump sees that and has said that during the G7 just this weekend to people, does that make you feel like there's at least a starting place where we can start to build some kind of understanding and we can get to that? If he can somehow resist all the people who are going to be in his ear telling him, no, Mr. Trump, they're bad, do not become friends with them.
Вот ви начали со слова оптимизм.
You started with the word optimism, that you feel there's room for optimism. I can say, yes, I'm optimistic too, even despite the fact that the administration is, well, changing in the White House. But I feel extra optimistic due to the fact that at last there is a person in the White House who speaks not about other parts of the world, who solves problems of people on other parts of the globe. But for the first time in decades, has said the truth to the American people and the world that America needs to solve a colossal number of problems of a colossal scale. That's something that's been concealed from the people of the United States for decades. I wouldn't call them Democrats. The Democratic Party in the United States is no more democratic than any other party. I think that has very little to do with democracy. They're representatives of liberal dictatorship, the ultra-liberalism. They've been hiding the most important thing, that America is in one hell of a crisis, economic, existential, and political. And now a person has come who had everything. He had money, fame, popularity, creature comforts, a great family. He had everything that he made for himself. And he has been a president before. He could have rested on his laurels, just living for himself. But he ran for presidency the second time, not for money, not for fame, but exactly to do the right thing, to try to save his own country. And this makes me extra optimistic, because I see a man who said two truthful things to his people. Number one, that America is in deep trouble. And the second is that there are no 3, 10, 25, or 85 genders. There are only men and women. Anybody can feel the way they want to. If they want to identify as a table or as three dogs at once, okay, you can get treatment for that, or you can continue identifying as that. But there were two genders created, man and woman. These are two basic states of a human. And everything else is just deception. So when I heard the President of the United States say two things that had been long concealed from the common Americans, that's when I felt that things might take a turn for better. Not even for better, but at least towards some normalcy.
I heard Mr. Putin recently say, as the president of Russia, that he can't see how you can negotiate with terrorists after the terrorist attacks that took place in Russia. Given that he is saying something like that, does that not bode well for the possibility of being able to come up with some negotiation to end the war in Ukraine?
Конечно, мы нет, ну вы же понимаете, что он имел в виду.
Of course, you understand what he meant. He meant that we can't talk to terrorists, we can't concede to terrorists, although they are making their last attempts, desperate attempts, to intimidate, or they just do terrorist attacks, well, out of desperation. We can't concede to them, we can't agree with them. It's inadmissible. And, well, it's textbook stuff, and Russia has been through all of that. And there's the negotiation process is underway, and Russia has been showing goodwill. We have responded to negotiation propositions in 2022. We held those talks. It wasn't us who finished those talks. Ukraine did that upon direct order from Boris Johnson. Yeah. Now we are in talks and there are specific results, although Zelensky says these are not results at all. And he said that two rounds of talks didn't lead to anything. There was an exchange of prisoners of war. But that's the essence of the Zelensky regime. He doesn't care about people.
Do you think Zelensky does not want a peace deal? De facto does not want a peace deal. Do you believe that? Based on what you've heard him say and what your knowledge is of the man.
Do you want me to consider Zelensky as well, a normal person? He's a person soaked with hatred to people of a different nationality. He's a person who has been for a long time addicted to drugs. Sorry, but I have to say that. He's a person who has been, well, spoiled by unlimited power by his Western curators. How do you want us to see him? How do you want us to analyze him? In fact, I don't care what he wants. I know what my country wants. I know what my people want. And I want what people want who had been asking Russia for many years to come and defend them, who had given their voices, who had voted during referendums, who had asked, pleaded Russia to come and defend them and to stop this madness, which had started long before Zelensky. This is what matters to me. This is what matters to all of us as a country. And as for what Zelensky sees in his drug dreams, well, I think that's up for him to, and Macron, to
I have
discuss.
To ask you about EU and NATO and the whole European feel and reaction to Russia. With the exception of maybe Slovakia and Hungary, I hear most European countries sound very angry about Russia all the time and filled with a hate that seems, I'm not sure where it comes from, but I look at their numbers, right?
I can say where that comes from. It's a whole range of feelings related to, well, jealousy. You are Christian, aren't you? You probably listen to sermons, you read the Bible, the Old Testament, and I think it won't be news to you that one of the biggest sins eating at a man's soul is jealousy and envy. Remember what started the first crime, the very first crime on earth. Well, the fall from grace was there was Adam and Eve, but the first crime on earth started with what? Cain and Abel, two brothers, one killing the other because of what? He didn't have where to live, or didn't have anything to eat. No, that was before, because of envy. Envy stemming from jealousy. because one sacrifice had been accepted by God and the others hadn't. So two brothers brought up in one family, and one kills the other because of jealousy. They are jealous, and that's the foundation of their hatred. What they're jealous? A vast country that has never attacked, that has never initiated a world war. A huge country, fields, meadows, forests, immense resources, the entire periodic table, oil and gas. And we're not claiming to become masters of the world, but we are ready to trade with everyone on equal terms. We're ready to share. We don't segregate people in classes or races or skin colors. We say that people are equal. We said that when we were the Russian Empire. We said that when we were the Soviet Union. And we're Christians. We've always been like that, although there are nations who confess Islam and Judaism. But in the Russian Empire, there was no slave trade. We talked about that in the Soviet Union as well. How can they forgive that? Forgive us for that. They've always been fighting for resources. We have plenty of resources. And we're not becoming an empire in their sense of the world.
So it must make you angry when you hear, especially knowing how much NATO has encroached on Russia, when you hear all these stories that I hear all the time from the UK and Germany and France and Macron, that your country is about to take over Poland. When you're done with Ukraine, you're going to take over Poland, and then you're going to take a bunch of other countries over, and soon you want to take over. I know it sounds ludicrous.
I really love your question. Why can't you make people understand on whose side truth is?
It's hard.
In the end of the 18th, beginning of 19th century, in the country then known as the Russian Empire, the entire aristocracy spoke French. They worshipped all things French. France to Russians was, they mentioned the Gallomania, an addiction to all things French. Even the laws of the Russian Empire late in the 18th century were published in French. Can you imagine that?
Really?
Yes, exactly. And then they were translated for the common people to read them.
Huh.
Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace.
Of course.
Know that, of course. Part of it is written in French. Wow. I mean, originally. Of course, our ancestors worshipped France once. It dominated as a culture. And how did that end? Napoleon attacked us. Can you imagine that France didn't know that the Russian Empire, the Russian elite, are so fond of all things French, the culture, the language, the art? They knew that perfectly. And then in the beginning of the 20th century, we have another addiction. We are addicted to ideas of Marxism originating from Germany. The ideas of progress, of Marxism. How did that end? We were attacked by Hitler. And the last thing, you can discard that as an accident. The 20th century, especially after 1980s, we completely embraced the Anglo-Saxon culture, the pop culture, the mass culture. Everybody speaks English. There's American movies everywhere. American movie stars coming over to Russia. So who hits us with the hybrid war? The Anglo-Saxons. So it's not because they don't know us or that we are bad at telling them the truth. Situation. The moment we start deviating from our own roots, from our own history, from our own national interests, we always get hit by those we seem so close to.
Yeah, it's fantastic. fantastic and fascinating to think that there's this long-term relationship. We're in St. Petersburg. This is as European a city as I've ever seen with my own eyes.
Yeah, we will keep Europe for Europeans for their future. When and if some from European, Central and Western European countries and citizens would like in the future to know more about their roots, they could come to St. Petersburg. Yes, because they're ruining their culture beyond repair.
It makes no sense. I need to change the subject a little bit because something happened today that I think is important. You know, RT is becoming one of the most powerful voices in the world of news, and it's happening with hundreds of millions of people all over the world who are trusting RT for whatever the reason that they choose. One of the new countries coming on board is Chile, a very large and important country in Latin America. I happen to be from Latin America, as you know, I'm sure. I was born in Cuba, emigrated to the United States. Russia's starting to play a big role in Latin America. Just how big a role do you think, and why is it necessary?
Well, I'm scared by the fact you're saying Russia is beginning to play a role in Latin America, especially you coming from Cuba. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about the new Latin America, not the Castro Latin America. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I thought during Castro's times things were different.
Yes.
Cuba received a lot, received a classical lesson in sovereignty, not a lesson not only for Cuba but for the whole world. But they withstood. They stood for justice, and they came out strong. I just like to mention why, out of the entire socialist bloc, Cuba was one of the few countries to persist, well, despite the American blockade. They had never given up God, and socialism in Cuba was going forward, but at the same time, there were no attempts, at least. I haven't heard of any attempts to give up religion or to ban religion. They didn't go against God, they didn't speak against God. That was never the case, and I think that helped Cuba retain what they held sacred. I think there's no new role for Russia in Latin America. Russia has always been there 100 years ago in 20th century, and now it's been there in different capacities, but it's always been there retaining one important characteristic. We have always been there with peace. Peace, friendship, cooperation, mutual help. We never tried to overturn regimes there just because we didn't like them. We always supported their fight for sovereignty. We always supported the native ethnicities' fight for freedom. We always helped them with education, with technology, science, and so on. Indeed, the 1990s were the time we couldn't pay as much attention to international issues. We concentrated on our own problems and issues. And now we come back there with new propositions, with new ideas.
But that was a different Russia. That was the Russia of your father, who was one of the finest diplomats this country had, working in places like China. The new Russia is a Russia that seems to me to be less interested in ideology and philosophy, and more interested in business, more interested in transactional relationships. That's the kind of thing that Russia's doing, not just in Latin America, but in Africa as well. Am I wrong?
Yeah, that's a large-scale question indeed. Well, I don't understand how you say Russia is focusing less on ideology and philosophy and more on business. Well, let's face it, we tried to be very pragmatic. We tried to build our relationships on the base of business, pure business, with Western Europe, for example. How did that end up? It ended up with the Nord Stream being blown up. Of course, this
was... Biden did that?
He said it himself. He said it himself. And I'll never forget how he and Nuland said they will destroy this project 6 months ago, 6 months later, it was blown up. And we realized, and so has the whole world, that without defending one's national interests, without having a clear understanding what those national interests are, it's, you're going to have a hard time building a business. So apart from businesses, apart from business projects and transactions on the international arena, Russia has been defending the traditional values that were suppressed over the last decades by the liberalism that Biden and Macron push forward, exterminating national identities, turning men and women into quad robbers. I wouldn't say Russia doesn't do philosophy right now. I think it does, only on a different level. You can't build a multipolar world without a philosophy foundation beneath it. It's going to be a colossus on clay legs. So philosophical foundation of international processes, of our own position in the world is there, of course. Our ideology, well, it's not probably written down in a few lines, but Russia's philosophy is that of traditional values. There's a very common human understanding of those values that are easy to formulate: love, cooperation, friendship, mutual support, mutual respect, things that seem to have been completely forgotten by Western leaders. You won't hear a public speech where they would talk about friendship, about common outlook, common world outlook. It used to be common in the 1980s, but it's not now. So, of course, we propose business, we propose joint projects in nuclear energy and space exploration. But we also suggest to think about the world of the future and its philosophy. Let's think about what the planet is going to be like in decades. In that sense, we have a lot to propose as well.
You are passionate. You are fiery. You believe.
I'm
truly
married.
Yeah.
No. I'm married.
Yeah, good for you.
Don't propose me.
I'm not, but I'm really taken aback by you come into this interview, and the first thing you said, and I should share this with those of you watching us, the first thing she said is, ask me anything.
No limit.
No limit.
Absolutely.
I'm not coming with rules. There's nothing you can't ask. There's nothing we
business.
Can't talk about.
I'm in. First of all, my background is faculty of international.
By the way, I'm married too.
Just in
case. Sorry.
My deep regrets. So, first of all, my background, I graduated Moscow State Institute for International Relationship, and my specialty is international information journalism. So I do respect journalists. It's just not a common word. It's my deep feeling to this profession. I know that this is a profession.
Yes.
It's not like come and go thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like about TikTok or tweets or something like that. It's about profession and about people who dedicate their lives to this profession and who rescue their lives.
Thank you.
And even rescue the lives of their families just to bring the truth to the world. This is my thirst pillar. Secondly, I'm in this information international so-called business for many years. I'm doing this job of official spokeswoman of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Russia for at least 10 years. And I have all questions you can imagine, tough, silly, smart, whatever, you name it. And even if these are very serious and very deep and very so-called tough questions, I always respect if they're asked in a respectful manner with the only goal to get the truth and to understand what is going on.
Hmm. Well, I want people to know that as a journalist working in Russia, unlike what people believe in the West, nobody tells me what to say. Nobody writes my scripts. I write my own stories. Of course, we collaborate on ideas.
You should double his salary.
But Can I tell you the truth? You know my background. I worked at CNN. I worked at Fox. I worked at NBC. I even did some stories for the BBC. I've worked at Univision. I'll tell you that in working at all of those places, some were good experience, but for the most part, they probably have more of a handle on my independent narrative than they do working here. So that says something, I think. That's worth listening to. It's not perfect, but it's important. And that's why when I interviewed you, when I interviewed Mr. Medinsky and others, I always say, did you tell me what I can ask you and what I can't ask you? And I want people to know it's not true.
Yes, because there is a difference between a journalist, correspondent, or moderator, and a parrot. These are two different things. Mm. You shouldn't just repeat something you've got in written or you've got in your ear. You should translate your own thoughts, your own vision. You should get your own, I don't know, your emotion about this. Of course, you're communicating with... The only thing I hate about journalism, I mean, today's journalism, nowadays journalism, this ear thing, when you are talking to a man or a woman and you are dealing with a human being with emotions and thoughts, and they get their information not from their brains but from the mic or from the earphone or something screen and reading, and they're not just reacting on what you are saying or telling them, they're just reacting what they get here, and this is terrible. But this is not a journalism. This is like, you know, showbiz.
Yeah, yeah. Public relations, maybe marketing.
No, showbiz.
Yeah.
Show business. This is a show business. They're not thinking, they're not analyzing, they're just repeating as a role. You know, they have a text.
Yeah.
They read this out, and this is it.
This has been a very fun conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving me your time, giving us your time, and giving us what you really think about this. And you're not shy about saying what you think, not even a little bit.
No, I'm not.
Oh, my goodness. That is the Sanchez effect. As you can see, we try and bring it to you raw and real, and we try and bring it to you in such a way so that it has no corporate spin or any political masters. It's what we do. We're so happy you've been there for us. Thank you so much.
I'm Rick Sanchez. Shy. You know, you shocked me with this question. Why should I be shy? I have an honor to represent Minister of Foreign Affairs of Russia, this great country with this great history, with great people who are struggling in our days for what is important, not only for them personally, but for their families and their relatives, their grandpas and grandmothers who just brought their lives that we might live. Why should I be shy? I should be insistive. I should be, of course, respective, but there should be passion in it.
Yeah. Tell Mr. Lavrov he's next.
I will.
Maria, you're a delight. Thank you so
much
for a wonderful and real conversation. Thanks so much. I'll be looking for you right here. This is The Sanchez Effect, and I am Rick Sanchez, and I did enjoy this conversation, and I hope you did too. We'll see you next time.